Sorry.
Thank you very much. And thank you to everyone for coming out tonight. I know it's like that busy time in the term where you start sort of canceling things and deciding to stay home in your pajamas and have some tea and hot cocoa. So I really appreciate you making the effort to be here. And also, I told Alicia that what I'm presenting is definitely one of the more sort of experimental aspects of my thesis. So this is giving me an opportunity to try out a few ideas that I'm trying to refine as I'm in the kind of final stages of my thesis writing. So it's a great opportunity for me to try out these ideas, and if you'd be willing to sort of think with me through some of these topics, I'd just really enjoy hearing your feedback at the end. So I won't try to summarize all of my last 4 years of research in the next 35 minutes, don't worry. But I thought I would focus on the part of my thesis that deals with developments in evolutionary biology and also the biology of sexual difference, and then try to give some ideas at the end for how I'm hoping to integrate that with thinking about sin. And so I'm not able, because of time constraints, to kind of give a total overview of all of my historical work that's also in the project. So I have a whole chapter on Augustine and what he thought about original sin and what he thought about sexual difference. And then also somebody by the name of Valerie Saving, who is an early feminist thinker. And as I'll sort of mention later in the thesis, she proposed, she had this idea that pride is a sort of male sin, and that women sin in a different way, and that women sin in a more of what she described as a negation of the self rather than kind of having too much self. So of course she was a very early feminist thinker, so she's been critiqued in many different ways since then, but she was a person who sort of made a contribution to the discussion. So anyways, I engage with their thought all the way and then say, how can we have a constructive approach to thinking through these issues that also is engaging with the materiality of sexed bodies? So I'm focusing just on the one aspect of my thesis, but I'm very happy to talk about the other elements during the Q&A if people are interested. So I apologize for reading. I'll try to read in a very engaged way, but it helps me kind of stay to the time and also make sure I say things the way that I want to say them. So. Okay, so I'm going to begin by just trying to give an overview of how our thinking is starting to change about the dynamics of evolution with something called the extended evolutionary synthesis, which some of you will be familiar with, and maybe it's completely new to others of you. So I'll give a bit of an overview of how scientific approaches to evolution are changing, and then a bit of an overview as to how scientific approaches to sexual difference are changing, and then at the end talk about how we might integrate that with sin. Okay, so we'll dive in here. It's a bit science heavy, but just hang with me. So Darwin believed that all living creatures descended from common ancestors, and that natural and what he called sexual selection were the primary drivers of evolutionary change. However, at the time that he was formulating his theories, he actually didn't have a way of understanding inheritance and how inheritance worked. So it turned out, conveniently enough, that at the same time that Darwin was crafting his theories, someone by the name of Gregor Mendel, an Augustinian monk actually, was also developing, in the same historical moment, what we now recognize to be an early theory of genetics. So we had these two theories being developed at the same time, but they weren't yet integrated. So it was then in the early 20th century that a group of mathematically oriented biologists began to demonstrate that Darwin's theory of adaptation through natural selection could be combined with how we think about genetics into a unified theory that explained how adaptations occur and then how those adaptations are transmitted to living organisms. So this combination of genetics and natural selection is now referred to as the modern synthesis. And this was sort of the predominant approach to understanding evolution for much of the 20th century. So the modern synthesis is a gene-centric theory, and it continues to occupy a place of prominence in the public imagination, particularly because of the influence of people like Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett, scientists who also write for a popular audience. So central to the modern synthesis has been the belief that all inherited variations can be expressed in terms of genetic differences. So within this framework, genes came to be portrayed as the sort of masterminds of evolutionary change. And sometimes with the language that they were described, it was almost as if genes were spoken about as possessing some form of agency, and organisms then were depicted sometimes as at the mercy of their genetic blueprint. Metaphorical language describing the genome as a blueprint and genes as information became then very pervasive within this framework. So by way of example, I have a quote here from Richard Dawkins, who says, "What lies at the heart of every living thing is not fire, not warm breath, not a spark of life. It is information, words and instructions. If you want a metaphor, don't think of fire, sparks and breath. Think about information technology." So I'm kind of drawing attention to the metaphor here of DNA and genes as information. So the modern synthesis taught that information, this information from the genes, moves in a one-directional way from genes to what is referred to as a phenotype. And the phenotype, it's a technical word that it kind of encapsulates the body, but also behaviors. I think a fast way of thinking about phenotype is to think about body and behaviors, but it is a bit more complicated than that. So you had this kind of idea that information moves in a one-directional way. You have the genetic blueprint, and then you get bodies and behaviors from the genetic blueprint. So this suggested to scientists at the time that if we could understand a given genome, this should yield relatively accurate predictions about the bodily constitution and the behaviors then of organisms possessing that genome. So this view of living beings as determined by their genetic makeup led to, at the time, some overly simplistic theorizing about human behavior that suggested there might be genes for various human characteristics and behaviors. So you may have seen over time articles in the newspaper like, "Have scientists discovered a gene for homosexuality or a gene for alcoholism?" And so this kind of, this is sort of how genes were spoken of at the time. And it still pops up from time to time in the media. This focused attention on the role of genes in evolution has, of course, been helpful in many ways, and it's contributed to some massive innovations in the field of evolutionary biology. However, problems with the way that the modern synthesis characterized the relationship between genes and phenotypes, or bodies and behaviors, began to emerge in the last half of the 20th century, and have now become more widely recognized as it's become clear that the functioning of the gene is largely context dependent. So indeed, organisms with identical genotypes or genomes frequently develop non-identical phenotypes. So you might have, again, a sort of identical genetic plan that then is expressed in non-identical ways, which we'll unpack this a little bit as we get further into the presentation. So there's now a growing appreciation for the fact that genes are formed by and function within systems over time. And that they can be properly understood only from within their given context. And this new awareness of the complex relationship between genes and context has been emphasized in what is now referred to as the extended evolutionary synthesis. So we've moved from the modern synthesis to the extended evolutionary synthesis. And the extended evolutionary synthesis is trying to, in a lot of different ways actually, capture this dynamic relationship between the environment and genes and how this kind of causation works between the environment and genes. So I'll give a few examples of some of the developments that are included under kind of the umbrella of the extended evolutionary synthesis. So genes have many possibilities for how they might be expressed, and the ones that ultimately manifest are largely dependent upon environmental factors. Furthermore, phenotypes, again, bodies and behaviors, are plastic, which means that a phenotype produced by a specific genotype can also change in response to the environment. And it seems then that there are also accommodations to the environment that can be heritable through a phenomenon called genetic accommodation. So I'll give now an example of what I mean by a genetic accommodation. So the one that's typically used in the biological literature is that of something called hypoxia tolerance. So The way that hypoxia tolerance works is that when you have low land inhabiting humans, which is I think most of us because we don't live at the top of a mountain range, when people like us, lowlanders, ascend to higher altitudes, we typically experience a range of responses to this change in altitude. So this can manifest in kind of rapid breathing and heart rate and the suppression of normal functions like digestion. As lowland humans become acclimatized to the higher altitudes, their bodies exhibit increased production of capillaries, mitochondria, and aerobic enzymes, and reduced stroke volume as a means of dealing with this hypoxia or kind of lack of oxygen. So most of us, we can struggle quite a bit when we go to higher altitude. However, in contrast, there are human groups who have lived for generations in these higher altitudes, and they seem actually at this point to have genetically adapted to their environment by developing hypoxia tolerance. And so this is really interesting to scientists because it seems like actually somehow the environment has caused a genetic change, which as you can see is really different from the sort of one directional relationship between genes to bodies. So that's hypoxia tolerance. So now you have groups of people living in Tibet who breathe faster and have a higher, on average, cerebral blood flow and significantly lower oxygen saturation. Similarly with people living in the Andes Mountains in South America, and also some groups within Ethiopia. So this basically has led scientists to realize that there's not this kind of one-directional movement of causation from genes to bodies and behaviors, but rather, and this is a quote from a person by the name of Evan Thompson. He says, "The causal chain between DNA sequences and phenotypic characteristics is too indirect, complex, and multifaceted for there to be any robust one-to-one relationship between them. Hence, no phenotypic characteristic can be said to be coded for by DNA sequences." So, basically trying to get away from this idea that if we just understand the genome, we can then understand what the body and the behaviors will look like of the organism. So genetic variation exists among different humans, but also within the same human over the span of a lifetime. So this significantly complicates previous understandings of the role of genes as determinants of an organism's traits and behaviors. Genes do not determine traits and behaviors on their own, but rather recent developments in evolutionary biology emphasize the role of constructive processes of development and evolution and what now scientists refer to as reciprocal processes of causation. So sort of all of these things in our milieu, our bodies, our genetic makeup, our surrounding, we have these, our bodies sort of taking in all this information, and that then is impacting how our bodies act and who we are as humans. Another feature of the extended evolutionary synthesis that maybe, I wonder if it's more familiar to some, is known as epigenetics. Epi just means above. So again, it's looking at things in addition to genes. So epigenetics is a term used to describe heritable changes in the expression of genes that are not dependent on changes in an organism's DNA. So in other words, people studying epigenetics show us that parents pass on a lot more than just their genes, but they also pass on switches or cues for how those genes are going to be expressed. So epigenetic changes typically happen within an organism because of contextual influences. So contextual influences could include things like parent and child interactions, social learning, also trauma, and there's a lot happening with kind of trauma studies and epigenetics. So I think that has really interesting implications for a doctrine of original sin, as we'll sort of develop a bit later. But yeah, so the idea is that developments in epigenetics indicate that changes in patterns of organisms' gene expression in response to environmental factors leave what are called epigenetic signatures or marks on the genome, and then these marks also can be inherited along with the sort of genetic DNA makeup. So for example, there have been many studies done on the descendants of Holocaust survivors, and these studies have indicated that the descendants of Holocaust survivors are born with similar of these sort of molecular switches that their parents were induced to develop from their trauma. So you have sort of literally trauma biologically being passed down to the descendants of Holocaust survivors. And often how this manifests is basically a higher rate of vulnerability to experiencing the negative effects of stress. So you have sort of quicker release of adrenaline and cortisol and less ability to kind of monitor the release of those hormones. So again, this is all really interesting to scientists because it shows that there's more of this kind of dynamic relationship between the environment and our genetic makeup. So in the words of one leading researcher in the area, some people, quote, have a lot more to overcome because of their biology, which has given their condition a firmer reality, especially members of human groups who have endured extensive prolonged trauma. So while epigenetics provide insights into how trauma can persist biologically for generations, a lot of the epigenetic researchers are also keen to show that resilience and healing are also epigenetic changes that can also be inherited. So it's not all negative, it's not just trauma that's being passed down, but also our own sort of molecular switches that we adapt in the course of our lifetime could potentially also be inherited in a positive way as well. So biological and molecular healing have the possibility of being inherited. So one final area related to it's an area underneath this umbrella again of the extended evolutionary synthesis is called the theory of niche construction. So a niche is basically our environmental context that we live in, and scientists working on theories of niche construction are showing that organisms basically make changes to their environmental niches that then impact the selection pressures within that environmental niche, which then impact kind of ongoing development of the species. So I think one example of this would just be the changes that we make to our environment that then impact climate change, then that impacts the bodies of kind of the generations coming after us. So again, you have this kind of dynamic relationship where the choices that we make are actually influencing the ongoing evolution of our species. So I think what this demonstrates is that the past is always with us, sometimes biologically in our bodies and in the form of epigenetics or molecular switches, but also in the environmental niche that we live in that has been sort of shaped and molded by the people who came before us and will be shaped and molded by us as well. So phenotypic plasticity combined with genetic accommodation, epigenetics, and niche construction, these are all considered elements of this new extended evolutionary synthesis that's a move beyond the modern synthesis of the 20th century. The extended evolutionary synthesis seeks a richer and more complex account of the interactions between genes and environments across the lifespan of individual organisms, species, and species across generations. It seeks to show the nuanced interplay between nature and culture, and also the impossibility of ever separating nature and culture. Culture is shot through with nature, and nature is always already cultural. On the one hand, the extended evolutionary synthesis reveals anew that organisms are shaped by forces and environments that they do not entirely control and of which they are not always even aware. It expands our understanding of the complexity of the ways in which our biological and cultural pasts are always part of us, all the way down to the level of our genes and the various possibilities for their expression, as well as in the ecological niches that surround us. The persistence of the past into the present means that some begin life with more to overcome than others, both biologically and also culturally. On the other hand, the extended evolutionary synthesis also reveals that organisms are not only inert and passive entities that are acted upon by forces of evolution, but also that we impact our environment and organisms around us, thereby shaping the direction and the pace of evolutionary change in the future. In the words of one niche construction theorist, organisms must be active as well as reactive, and this is just part of kind of how evolution works. Through our active living in the world, through our aesthetic tastes, through our romantic loving, our dreaming and our longing, through our religion and our habits, we constantly mediate and adapt the world that we have received from those who've gone before. We shape the cultural and biological world that will be passed on. The extended evolutionary synthesis is changing how we think about what it means to be humans who are embedded in an evolutionary milieu, and the dynamic picture it paints also has relevance for how we think about what it means to be humans who are differently sexed. So I want to turn now to, instead of sort of looking at the general picture of how thinking about evolution has changed, see how these developments in evolution have also changed how we think about the biology of sexual difference. Okay, so as I mentioned, Darwin had what he called a theory of sexual selection, and I won't explain it in detail here, but essentially he argued that evolution had favored the development of a male nature that was passionate, competitive, and promiscuous, while women, he argued, were discriminating, passive, and coy. The male, he argues, is the more active member in the courtship of the sexes. The female, on the other hand, is coy and requires to be courted. So even in kind of the language, you can hear some of the sort of Victorian sexism, for sure, but also the kind of Victorian milieu that Darwin lived in that shaped even sort of the metaphors that he used. Because Darwin thought that sexual selection exerts more pressure on males than it does on females, he theorized that sexual selection had favored the development of male superiority over females in physical size, but also in intellectual ability. According to Darwin, even if there are a few exceptions, within most species, it is the males who are forced to evolve superior traits so that they will be selected for mating and reproduction, whereas females have much less pressure to develop advanced intellectual abilities and physical strength, since the choice of mates generally lies with them, at least in Darwin's kind of his interpretation of evolution. Darwin thought that this accurately described the situation of humans. As a contemporary commentator, Angela Saini, summarizes, Darwin thought that women were literally less evolved than men. Indeed, in The Descent of Man, one of Darwin's other books besides The Origin of Species, he argues, quote, "The chief distinction in the intellectual powers of the two sexes is shown by man attaining to a higher eminence in whatever he takes up than women can attain, whether requiring deep thought, reason, or imagination, or merely the use of the sense in the hands. And this led him to conclude that man had ultimately become superior to the woman." So Darwin's theory of sexual selection was neglected for a really long time by evolutionary biologists. But there were actually two landmark scientific papers that at first glance seemed to confirm his conclusions about a kind of natural male nature and a female nature. The first paper was by a botanist and geneticist named Angus Bateman in 1948. So Bateman used a series of experiments with the mating behavior of fruit flies to demonstrate that, quote, "There is nearly always a combination of an undiscriminating eagerness in males and a discriminating passivity in females." Bateman's conclusions supported Darwin's notions of the more eager and the more passionate and competitive nature of males, as well as the greater force of sexual selection upon males. So kind of confirming that that males would inevitably become superior to females because of these greater selection pressures. The second important paper was authored by a man by the name of Robert Trivers in 1972. Trivers' paper was entitled Parental Investment in Sexual Selection. He examined Bateman's experiment from 24 years earlier and supported it through the additional notion of what he called parental investment. Trivers argued that evolution inclines females to be less passionate and more what he called choosy, because they have more to lose if they get stuck with a disadvantageous partner, since females have a limited number of eggs to fertilize, while men have, these are his words, a lot of sperm with nowhere to go. Beyond just their limited number of eggs, he argued, females, and especially mammals, invest more time and energy into nurturing the fertilized egg until it becomes eventually a baby, and then nurturing the child until it reaches a point of independence. This greater investment on the part of the female means that she is motivated to choose a high quality partner, again, according to Trivers, and has nothing to gain from being promiscuous, while the male's low parental investment and high sperm count provides him with an evolutionary drive to be promiscuous. So once again, Darwin's theories initially seemed to be confirmed. And you had this again popping up in sort of the popular media about men are wired to be promiscuous and women are wired to not be promiscuous, basically. So these fundamental notions about the biological nature of being male and female that were expressed early on by Darwin and then supported by Bateman and Trivers have continued to be championed by some scientists and psychologists studying biological sex differences up to the present day. However, the last few decades have seen an influx of new and I think exciting studies challenging the conclusions of Darwin, Bateman, and Trivers. For example, in 2007, so not that long ago, evolutionary biologists Brian Snyder and Patricia Gowody sought to re-examine and replicate Bateman's original experiments from the 1940s with updated information and technology. They found many serious problems with Bateman's original data, among them the fact that Bateman established his conclusions about male promiscuity and competition and female choosiness by focusing on the results of only two out of his six experiments. And coincidentally, the two experiments that he highlighted were the ones that most supported his arguments about sex differences. When Snyder and Gowody combined the insights of all six of Bateman's experiments, they argue that Bateman actually could have claimed the first evidence for a benefit of promiscuity for females, so exactly the opposite of what Bateman argued. Unfortunately, most of the research after Bateman relied on the data that he himself presented without sort of questioning it or looking at the broader picture. And so discussions about sexual selection and the biology of sexual difference have continued to propagate the myth of male promiscuity and competition and female passivity. In addition to the critical work done by Snyder and Gowody, there have been other key contributions lately in the scientific literature regarding the biology of sexual difference that further challenge these traditional scientific dogmas about what it means to be male and female. For example, despite the claims of Darwin, Bateman, and Trivers about the stable nature of females as choosy and males as promiscuous because of the difference in the cost of reproduction for each, a scientist by the name of Donald Dewsbury and others have argued in recent decades that males are more selective than has been acknowledged to date by evolutionary biologists, and that ejaculation and reproduction incur non-trivial costs for males that should be taken into account when considering their sexual behaviors. So kind of challenging this idea that men just have sort of unlimited sperm that they're driven to kind of inseminate into anyone that they can. A lot of recent research sort of trying to question some of those conclusions. Dewsbury argues further that despite traditional claims that males produce unlimited numbers of gametes and are selected to distribute them among all available females on a hit and run basis, in practice, he argues, sperm, semen, and behavioral factors limit the number of females that the male of any species can inseminate. Males do not produce unlimited sperm, and other limitations like female choices and the cost of courtship means that we should actually expect males to instinctually exhibit choosiness rather than rampant promiscuity. He concludes that there is ample evidence that males can and do discriminate among females, mating preferentially with some females. This applies to human and non-human species. So in addition to biological forces that might impel both males and females to demonstrate discrimination in partner choice, it's becoming more apparent as well that popular assumptions about men naturally desiring to have multiple sexual partners and finding monogamy to be a burden are also myths reflecting little about the realities of the sexual preferences of actual men. Note, for example, that the 2003 British National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles, which randomly sampled more than 12,000 people between the ages of 16 and 44, found that for both men and women, the majority identified their ideal relationship as being a sexually exclusive one with one partner. The notion that males are by nature more prone than females to promiscuity and infidelity because of the lower cost to them of reproduction appears to be an inaccurate narrative that perhaps reveals more about the wishful thinking of proponents of the theory than the sexual behaviors of actual men and non-human males. Another key voice contributing to the challenging of some of these traditional dogmas about sexual difference is a primatologist and anthropologist named Sarah Hurdy. It's H-R-D-Y. So through her work with primates, the closest evolutionary cousins to humans, Hurdy has contributed groundbreaking research detailing the dynamics of female competition, female aggression, promiscuity, but also cooperation in nature. For example, in her book entitled The Langers of Abu, Female and Male Strategies of Reproduction, she argues that the females within a species of monkeys known as langurs in northwestern India were habitually promiscuous because male langurs would attack the infants of unfamiliar females, but not the infants of females that they had mated with. So in this case, actually, female promiscuity offered a survival advantage for a female and her offspring, and so a sort of natural impetus for a female to be promiscuous. She notes in the 2009 edition of her monograph, The Woman Who Never Evolved, that anthropologists have become aware of populations in both traditional and modern human societies in which similar patterns have emerged of mothers using sexual relationships with multiple men in order to secure provisions and protection for their children. So of course, it's not to give a kind of, to say, look, we're all promiscuous and this is a good thing or something, but just to say that there's a diversity of behaviors in nature and to kind of problematize that males are always the promiscuous ones and females are not the promiscuous ones. The level of promiscuity that's practiced among members of a particular sex, Hurdy argues, is dependent not just on one's essential nature, but rather on one's ecological, demographic, historical, and immediate circumstances and the various options that are open. In her more recent monograph, Mothers and Others, The Evolutionary Origins of Mutual Understanding, Hurdy argues that humans are unique in their development of what she calls cooperative breeding. Through her studies with various people groups, Hurdy describes the phenomenon of cooperative breeding, which simply means that unlike with primates, human offspring do not stay constantly attached to their birth mothers. So she says actually it's really interesting that with a lot of primates, the mother actually won't let anyone else touch the infant for sometimes a long time, 6 months to a year, and that humans are sort of unusual and that pretty much right away we're happy for other people to hold the baby and to kind of help with the care of the baby. So she says actually this is a really important evolutionary development that has led to many actually pro-social behaviors and the development of empathy because children get sort of exposure to lots of different people that they then learn to empathize with. So she argues that the prevalence of cooperative breeding among humans indicates, against the conclusion of Robert Trivers, that our way of understanding parental investment should be expanded beyond this traditional dogma that the investment primarily comes from the birth mother. So she's showing how basically it takes a village to raise a child. And additionally, she argues, our assumptions about an innate maternal instinct must change as well. A person's responsiveness to infants, she argues, is to a large degree acquired through experience, through both the experience of nurturing and the experience of being nurtured. Furthermore, even something as central to being male as the hormone testosterone, it's becoming recognized that levels of testosterone are widely variable depending on contextual factors. Testosterone levels are, in the words of Cordelia Fine, inextricably intertwined with the individual's history and subjective experience, rather than existing as an incontrovertible example of biological sexual difference. A 2011 study found that testosterone levels in males significantly decreased in fathers, and especially in fathers who invested time in tending to young children. This leads me to wonder how the nature of masculinity might change in the long term if societal expectations regarding the care of children encourage men to be the primary caregivers. This is not to say that there's no statistical or meaningful differences in the biology of being male and female, or that these differences don't matter. I'm simply pointing out that the biological sexual differences that we observe are plastic, and they are continually being influenced by contextual and cultural factors. Both males and females possess impulses to nurture and capacities to empathize, but the extent to which these capacities develop or atrophy can be largely influenced by cultural and societal roles. So these have been just a few examples of how the scientific information about the nature of sexual difference and sexual selection has been changing in recent years. A lot of these kind of assumptions about biologically what it means to be male and biologically what it means to be female being challenged, and I think a lot of new exciting information coming out. So the salient point for this chapter in this presentation is to show the broad diversity really of sexual characteristics and behaviors at play in the natural world. In order to hopefully challenge simplistic narratives about the nature of sexual difference and, as we get to a bit later, the possibility of different gendered sins. So it's not to say that there are no stable biological differences in human beings, but it is to suggest that the story is more complicated than the received dogmas about natural female passivity and choosiness and natural male promiscuity. As Hurdy summarizes in her most recent book, female animals, including humans, are viewed as highly variable creatures, sometimes monogamous, often polygamous, sometimes nurturing or cooperative, other times competitive, destructive, and as likely as their male counterparts to strive for status in the spheres that matter to them. For better or for worse, they are wide open to Darwinian selection. There's a great amount of plasticity in the behaviors associated with sex bodies, and culture is always entangled with nature such that there are no purely natural sexual differences that exist independently from cultural influences. A senior researcher in this field, Mary Jane West Eberhard, argues that of all the major transformations in the history of life, the evolution of sex is the most enigmatic. Okay, so we've had kind of an overwhelming amount of scientific information, both with generally scientific theory and then also developments in the biology of sexual difference. So what does this all mean for theological considerations, both of original sin and also theologies of sex and sin? So let's start first with original sin, and then we'll move to sexual difference. So I attempt in the thesis to show actually that some of Augustine's original insights about original sin are especially relevant in our time. Not all of them, of course, because he lived in the 400s, but that surprisingly some of the things he had to say about original sin are still relevant. So I argue that a productive approach to rethinking original sin in our time, in conversation with both evolutionary biology and theology, is to see the human person as a product of an evolutionary past that continues to exert influence, as an entity shaped by multiple intersecting systems with a certain degree of agency but not totally unbounded possibilities. Every human at the moment of conception immediately becomes a participant in a biological, evolutionary, genetic, affective, cultural history that she did not choose. Rather, she receives this history in all of its glory, pain, possibility, limitation, and complexity. Evolutionary biology reminds us that the past decisions made by our ancestors, their experiences of trauma, our own early childhood experiences, and the forces of nature that came before us remain always with us, as I said, literally in our bodies. Although this same evolutionary approach promises that we are not completely constrained by these histories. Desire, for example, which is so central to Augustine's understanding of what it means to be human and to his understanding of what can go wrong in humans relating to each other and to God, is a complex phenomenon that defies reduction to genes, social construction, or individual choice, but it is somehow a dynamism of all of these forces. Augustine was correct, I think, in his intuition that desire is of central importance to human activity, but the physiology of desire is more complex than he knew. Desires are not spontaneous, but rather are learned from observation of the desires of others and are also shaped by physiological experiences and memories. These can become so sedimented in the affective memory of the body that they become unconscious. To understand the workings of desire requires reflection on many levels of organization, from the subcellular to the sociocultural. So I argue in the thesis that I don't think we necessarily need to subscribe to Augustine's belief in a single original human pair, so one man and woman from whom the entire race then genetically descended, in order to affirm his notion of inherited sin and inherited culpability. The more we learn about evolution, the more it becomes clear that basic reliance on the other should be considered even more profoundly, and namely at the level of the very self-formation of the human person. There is no self that exists except in relation to other selves, both present and past selves. We are radically interconnected and interdependent, even across species and all the way down to the molecular level. So all the stuff about epigenetics, I think, just shows how even in our bodies, the decisions, again, the sins, the traumas of everything that happened before shapes us from the moment that we're conceived. So we can't escape that. And I think that that's the insight of Augustine's view on original sin that is now being shown in a much more material, biological way by some of these developments in the sciences. Every human person is both constrained by her evolutionary history and propelled by it into new creative possibilities. But there is no human person who exists independently from the various conflicting forces of both nature and culture. Human nature and human culture are always inextricably intertwined, and these processes are further entangled with those of the rest of creation. So again, this reality troubles a strict nature-culture dichotomy, which is helpful for a reconstruction of the doctrine of original sin, insofar as the doctrine assumes a unity of the human species and a sense in which sin is an inherited but not necessary part of human nature. Augustine's notion of inherited sin and his understanding of the human race as radically united present helpful theological resources for reconsiderations of the doctrine of original sin in the 21st century as we seek to understand our histories of suffering and triumph. In light of our evolutionary history, Augustine's fixation on unity perhaps did not even go far enough. We're united in biological and cultural solidarity with those who are alive now, as well as those who came before us and those who will follow afterwards. In the words of one scholar on original sin, before being able to choose, we are merely by being historically situated, inextricably caught in an immense web of reciprocity and evil that one cannot escape and that has forming power. In our unity with one another, and we share our culpability in restoration, as well as our sickness and our healing. So that's a bit of an overview of kind of what I'm trying to do with the science, and then to bring that into dialogue with thinking about original sin. But what about sin and sexual difference in light of everything that we've heard? I argue in my thesis that Christian thinking about original sin and the fall have carried assumptions about the meaning of sexual difference since its earliest iterations. And we can talk about this more in the Q&A if you'd like. But briefly, I'll just say, so you have in some of the giants in the tradition, like Augustine and Aquinas, the figure of Eve is often interpreted as symbolic of feminine nature, so kind of universal feminine nature. Women are portrayed as lower down on the hierarchy of being and closer to natural processes, and are thus associated with sensuality, sexuality, and desire. Men are portrayed as higher up on the hierarchy of being, and thus rightly entrusted with the task of ruling over and subduing women. Conversely, some feminist theologians have suggested, as I mentioned at the beginning, that pride is a male sin, or at least a more typical male sin. Pride is sort of domination and having too much of a self, or a self that takes up too much space, and that negation of self is a more typically feminine sin. I end up arguing in the thesis that I do think that it makes sense that sin can manifest in different sexed ways, given the fact that we do have bodies that have these evolutionary histories, but that these manifestations should never be categorized into sort of fixed notions of male sins and female sins. We might identify potential tendencies of different gendered sins based on our recognition of the legacy of patriarchy that continues to exert shaping power over the development of sexual differences. But these tendencies must always be held tenuously, I argue, in light of the unpredictable and open-ended nature of human beings who are in a state of continual evolution. While the potentialities of human sexual difference are constrained by the sins of our evolutionary history, they're also open to the dynamisms of grace at work in a world that is charged with the grandeur of God. So I'll finish there. Thank you very much.